Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. I do it for an audience of real entrepreneurs. In fact, many of the people you've seen me interview have said, hey, I listened to these interviews while I was building my company. I built a company, and now I get to come back and tell my story. And I consider that the circle of Mixergy. I'm hoping every single person who listens to me has that kind of experience here today. And today's guest is an entrepreneur who came from a part of the world in a time when entrepreneurship was actually not encouraged. In fact, in some ways, it was an insult to say that you were entrepreneurial and capitalist-minded. And still, he was. He felt like this is who he was from the beginning, and we'll talk about how that expressed itself back then. Throughout the years, he kind of got closer and closer and closer to being an entrepreneur, and then whammo, he hit on this idea through a co-founder that I think you guys are going to think is just absolutely brilliant. The app that he came up with is called Hooch. You pay them just under 10 bucks a month, and they let you have one drink every single day at some high-end, really cool bars in your area. And it's doing phenomenally well, but it had a hard start, especially because it's alcohol, and a lot of businesses, a lot of investors don't want to get close to alcohol. So we're going to find out how he came up with this idea, how he got his first users, how he's expanding beyond this, where his revenues are, and why he was scared off of entrepreneurship, what that experience was early on, and then how he got back into it. This whole interview is sponsored by two phenomenal companies. The first will help you hire your next phenomenal developer. It's called TopTal, and since I'm using the word phenomenal over and over, I'm going to say the second one will host your website phenomenally well. It's called HostGator, but I'll talk about both those later. Lynn Dye, co-founder of Hooch. Good to have you here. No way. Did I just lose you? There we go.
Lost me for a second.
There we go. It froze. Good. I'm glad that you're back. So, good to have you on here. Since you're back, I don't know what happened to our connection there for a second. Let's talk about revenue. How much revenue did you guys do in the last year?
Yeah, we're doing a little over 2 million ARR. We're growing kind of 3-4x every year.
2 million annual recurring revenue.
Correct.
That means in the last 12 months, you guys have put in 2 million?
That means...
I think you mean run rate, right? 2 million meaning if you take last month's revenue, multiply it by 12, you end up with $2 million, right?
Correct.
Okay, and it is a recurring revenue model.
It is. We had over 24-month straight growth, and it is a recurring revenue model at that.
And it started out with this thing that I described, which is 10 bucks, just under 10 bucks a month. We'll round it up here. But about 10 bucks a month gets people one drink a day at popular bars, or not popular, but exclusive, interesting bars. Now you guys launched this new service, Hooch Black. How much is that, and what does somebody get for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, regular Hooch is membership is $10 a month, and you receive about 30 free cocktails every month, and that's about $400 to $500 worth of value every month. So the new Hooch Black membership is $295 a year, which breaks out down to about $25 a month. And in addition to all the great cocktail, 365 cocktails a year that you can enjoy, you get access to a few more things. So travel perks. We have a private in-app booking engine that give you access to deals at over 100,000 top hotels at about 20 to 60% better rate than Expedia. So, the hotel industry really published their rate publicly, and they, for the most part, 90% of hotels sign deals with Expedia, contracts with Expedia that says, they can't publish any rate lower to the public than what they show on Expedia because Expedia has buying power. We're able to offer, since, Hooch Black is a private membership organization, we can offer to our member what's called unpublished rates. So those could be, as low as $170, $180 at a W hotel in San Francisco or New York, and could be as low as, $20 to $30 for a 4 to 5 star hotel in Las Vegas. So really incredible deals, and it's a live search engine that we built in. There are additional, also for Hooch Black members, you have additional dining perks. So at hundreds of restaurants across, dozens of cities, you'll get a priority reservation at top restaurants such as Tao or STK. And with your reservation as a Hooch Black member, you may get a round of, you know, free champagne or a round of cocktails for your entire table, or sometimes, you know, such as at Mr. C or STK, you even get 20% off your entire bill.
Okay, so I get it. What I'm curious about is, and I want to know how you built it up, but one more question about how it works now, and then we'll build up to how you got here. The model, these restaurants, you don't have to pay them for the drinks. They give the drinks away for free. Do they pay you to be included, or are they just doing it for free?
Yeah, so you know, it's a free promotion for the restaurant, so the restaurant doesn't pay us, and we also don't pay the restaurant. So you know, when I was starting this app, we kind of observed this unique phenomenon. There's two things very interesting about this model. One is I saw that everybody likes a free drink. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. You know, in New York, when you go to a club or bar, you know, sometimes the door person will give you a paper ticket. It looks like a Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, you know what? Well, let's save it because I want to get it. I want to build that into the story. But the bottom line is there is no payment. You get paid by the customer, and then you don't have to pay for the drinks. And I know that they sometimes pay you for promotional featuring within the app, right? That's
correct.
The model.
Correct. For the most part, the bar gives you a drink in order to, you know, drive a customer into the door. So we're a free marketing service for the bars.
All right, let's go back to this thing that I said in the intro, which was you grew up in a country where entrepreneurship was not encouraged. I can't believe it for somebody like you. This is Shanghai in the 80s. What was it like in Shanghai in the 80s?
Very different. You know, I grew up in Shanghai. I lived there until I was 12. You know, I was a very kind of studious student. You study, you know, the education system in China is quite amazing, but obviously they're not teaching anyone about capitalism, and I kind of somehow naturally gravitated towards that for no reason that, you know, my family can discern. But I used to sell like candy to my classmates, and I would buy, you know, kind of like Starburst and you know, a whole bag of them for maybe a dollar, and sell each piece for a quarter each. So, which is like, you're not supposed to do that. And that was you know, I remember one of my aunt would used to call me, I have capitalistic tendency, and that was not meant as a compliment. You know, when my family moved to the U.S. You know, my father is a professor at Arizona State University. So we moved, you know, I kind of fell in love with a couple of things in the United States. You know, number one, they took me to Disneyland the first week I landed. So I was like, wow, doesn't matter how much money you have in China, you can't buy this level of happiness. That was kind of my 12-year-old mind. And the second thing was just the ability for me to choose my own classes in junior high and high school. So I had the opportunity to kind of participate in kind of computer classes and also intro to business class in my freshman year in high school. That was not, you know, elective curriculum is not a thing in China at all. So that really opened my eyes and doors, you know, because prior to that, if you ask what I want to do when I grow up, I would say, you know, I want to be a chemistry professor because that's what my father was. That's the only thing I know. And then after I, you know, kind of start taking business classes, so I really found that, you know, that was something I can be passionate about.
You were in Carnegie Mellon University when you and two other friends decided to found your first company. It was called KiwiBox. What was KiwiBox?
Yeah, so KiwiBox is kind of the first distributed publishing magazine, online magazine for teenagers with a big kind of social network component built in for teens. You know, even though back then the word social network was not even invented, we built a publishing system that basically millions of teens are part of, and they are contributing articles and they're sharing articles and grouping them into a weekly magazine for other teens to read. We had about 2 million teens on the website, and that was about pretty much like 90 some percent of every teen that was online at that point. So it was quite a phenomenon. We built a really organic business that just grew a lot.
I'm looking at an early screenshot of it from Wikipedia, and looks like this these group of people who are going to the prom were on the homepage. There was a post about Johnny Depp, the star of, I guess it's Sleepy Hollow. It's a little hard to read. You guys were offering Kiwi points. You were offering Postboard. You did a bunch of different things here that were really pioneers. You did fairly well in this space. I forget how many you guys had. Where's that Wikipedia article? Kiwi Box. You had a huge audience. Anyway, then you raised some money from whom, and what happened with that?
Yeah, so we grew organically for a while. The backstory of this was we were, me and my partners were actually building the software behind everything. We were building a CMS system that we thought we could sell to major publishers and magazine companies. And we were a little naive and as college students, and we built a pretty cool system, right? So the idea was, if you're a magazine company, your editors or writers don't need to actually learn how to code HTML. So in 1999, you kind of had to know how to code HTML to put up a website. So we're like, this is just a database. You copy and paste your content in here, you'll format it, and you'll publish it. As a demo, we recruited English majors at Carnegie Mellon and wrote up a bunch of story about Backstreet Boys and whatever teen content there is as a teen magazine demo. And that kind of organically took off as we were trying to sell the software.
Oh, so your whole vision was not to create this the site, but was to create the CMS, the content management system behind it. It just happened that the site took off.
We literally kind of, I sent my partners down and I was like, look, I think the play here is we are a content company and we're not a, we're not a software company, right? Because we actually sucked at selling it to magazine companies. And, magazine company wanted to offer us like $30,000 for the software when we were trying to sell it for $150,000. So the content idea took off. We grew, we kind of worked on it organically for a while. And then we had a lot of VC interest. And then one of the VCs was a European VC fund that came in. And really kind of put a great deal on the table, and we really want to kind of take the company to the next level. But we were a little bit naive about the type of deal to sign. It's our first kind of actual institutional deal. So we were a little naive in basically thinking that, like, we saw eye to eye with the team that came to us. So we signed a deal that, in all our expectation, it will go really well. But the market took a downturn, and the U.S. Subsidiary team of the VC all got fired.
The people you liked, who you signed the deal all disappeared.
They disappeared. They got booted off the board. Remaining board member. So the European company came in and replaced the entire board. I was a college founder mentality. I was like, well, this is my company. You can't run it without my approval or me, right? So I got very confrontational with the new board, who was like very concerned about how to recoup their investment. And I feel like didn't see the long-term vision, didn't share the long-term vision as we got into this deal with, later, as I learned, was not good. Do not get into a confrontational stage with your board. Your company is kind of a baby, I say, right? So, and then it grows as you take more investment. Now it becomes a teenager, and now at some point it's a young adult. It's its own entity. It has its own social security number for actual, as an entity. So, any one person is not the beginning or end of the company.
But you didn't know that, because the term founder seems to imply a lot of power. In reality, the term founder isn't even a legal term. It's not like CEO or secretary or CFO. it's just a title. In fact, I've seen people give it to like the fifth hire at a company, the person who's just there in exchange for reducing their salary. I'll call you a founder. All right. So you were, bottom line, you weren't as important as you thought you would be. You were booted out of the company. And as a result, you end up staying away from entrepreneurship for a little bit. Instead, you go on to work for big media companies, just to kind of fast forward through this. Like MTV, a casting director there, Alloy Media. Is there any one of these that taught you a lot that you're bringing some of what you learned there to entrepreneurship?
Yeah, you know, I definitely really appreciated my time spent at Alloy. So Alloy, Alloy Media, you know, is a teen media company that at one point owned a lot of great intellectual properties such as Gossip Girls, Vampire Diaries. And I really worked under a CEO who's tremendous, Matt Diamond, who really had a vision and was really open to kind of, you know, self-starters. So it's a big media company that was traded for hundreds of millions of dollars publicly. And, you know, he you know, for actually the funny part was at QBox actually competed with Alloy for quite a while. And you know, Matt was really open to hearing my ideas on how to kind of take Alloy to the next level. And so we had a chance to I had a chance to really work on a lot of different digital mergers and acquisitions, a lot of build out of a digital advertising network at the beginning of also video content and branded entertainment. So we were pretty early on. A lot of the cutting edge media and what's kind of the YouTube ecosystem and everything today, I had an opportunity because the CEO really let me kind of take the reins and work a lot on that.
Sorry. So I think we just lost audio for a second. So KiwiBox, you ended in about 2008, right? In 5 years, you spent working for bigger media companies.
Yes.
And then you told our producer, I needed to inch my way back to entrepreneurship. And the way that you did that was what?
I joined a mobile video startup out of Toronto. They were building something really interesting. They were one of my clients, and they basically had an early predecessor to what eventually Instagram video started doing. So they had this app where, you know, teens or young adults can take videos of on their smartphone and share with anybody in their network. So you know, I was like, maybe this video thing, this on mobile is going to go somewhere. So I should, you know, I want to take a shot at this. So I became their, not the founder, but I became the chief marketing officer. We did some really cool things. You know, very early on with one of the very first, kind of celebrity influencer deals with the Kardashian family, that netted a company tens of millions of users, not only in the US, but also
Wait, what did you guys do with the Kardashian family?
Everybody in the Kardashian family, from Kim to Mom to Scott Disick, were kind of paid influencers. They were exclusively using the Keek app to video anything for a year.
So you guys paid them for a year to go... Wow. Okay.
Yes, but that was at a time when you know, they may not be that bankable yet. This was when kind of after Kim's hydroxycut deal and before, you know, Gap and everything else. So we're kind of one of the first digital company to really kind of embrace the Kardashian family because they're true influencers. So that was great, and actually. From kind of the data we saw, you know, from a very early age, we knew Kylie Jenner was potentially the most influential out of the entire clan.
Because? So,
Because, you know, the teen audience on our platform that was following her, just really the engagement was super high every time she posts any video. So she was just kind of connecting to audience in a different way. I think, Kendall was more kind of aspirational. You look up to her, but you don't feel like you are her or she is your best friend. Kylie had that kind of very kind of down to earth appeal to everyone else. So, which is interesting. So.
And this was your doing, right? You're the one who brought that partnership together?
Well, I mean, there was a whole team, marketing team that had that. But
whose idea was it?
That was kind of me, our CEO, our US-based CEO, kind of we were kind of brainstorming on how to really bring this video app that was largely unknown in the US to everyone. And, you know, it was a little bit of a gamble to kind of go after the Kardashians, but it was well worth it. The company later got taken public on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and it grew to about 75 million users under our watch. So that was a great story. So
I guess, you know what, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it feels like you went from being a guy on the outside to then working within big media, MS Communications, Alloy, VH1, MTV, right? I guess MTV was earlier. And as a result, it feels to me like you got closer with the celebrity world and understood their power, where a lot of people coming out of Carnegie Mellon University would have laughed it off. You seem to understand it. Or maybe I'm just drawing too many conclusions from the little facts I have. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I would say end of the day, I'm still a nerd. I'm very data driven. So I'm pretty good at picking up what works and what doesn't, right? So kind of from obviously, if you ask any of my classmates at Carnegie Mellon, nobody would thought like I would have anything to do in the celebrity world. But, you know, from very early on KiwiBox, we just saw the power of anytime we put up a piece of content about Backstreet Boys or NSYNC or Britney Spears, that was the amount of engagement that we had. So I was like, I thought that was really interesting. That was that like the celebrity had like power on the internet digitally in a way we never really understood in 1999, right? So when we moved the company to New York, we actively and we actually seek out different partnerships with record labels, and I actually accidentally stumbled upon a partnership with MTV when I was because remember TRL, when thousands of teens would be in Times Square screaming at the studio. I was walking by one day and I saw, somebody that looks like he's in charge. So I went to speak to him and he was a casting director. So I was kind of asking him about his job, and he was looking to, his job is bring audience, teen audience to these shows. And he was casting for a show, a private concert for Britney Spears. And I told him I run this teen social network with about 2 million teens on there, we can probably send out a message. We drove so many people to the taping that, MTV formed a partnership with us. So, so that's kind of being at the right time at the right place, but also not afraid to, ask the question, right? So we literally wrote up to somebody that, I never met before and talk them up and introduce myself. So that's kind of being an entrepreneur a little bit.
All right. Let me take a moment to talk about my first sponsor, and then I want to understand why you ended up leaving that company after you're doing so well. The company's called TopTal. Have you hired from TopTal? Do you know TopTal yet?
I haven't, but they sounds like a great company.
Well, here's how... I was sitting at dinner with this guy named Drew, Drew Gorham, and he happened to be using TopTal too. He ran a company called The App Factory. I said, "What's The App Factory?" He says, "What I do is I create apps for other companies. They hire me and my team to create it." I said, "How big's your team?" He goes, "Really, Andrew?" I go, "Yeah, how big's your team?" And he goes, "Actually, I don't have anyone really on my team." I said, "Then how are you building all these apps?" He says, "All right, here's how I work. I'll be open with you." He says, "What I do is when I get a client, I go to TopTal. I hire the developers from TopTal. I know I'm going to get phenomenal developers from there. Those TopTal developers can get my email address, like at his domain.com. so they can interact with clients and represent him well. But he says, I don't do any of it. I just guide them. I get the business and these guys go and build the apps for me. I said, that's phenomenal. Can I talk about it? And he said, I don't know. So I banked it. I thought about it. I said, this is phenomenal that there are agencies out there that actually I've heard of enhance their developer crew by hiring from TopTal whenever there's somebody who, whenever they have a client who needs a specialty that they don't have in-house. I never heard of an agency that was built all on TopTal, but apparently Drew and a few others are doing it. It took me a little while, and then I finally got permission to talk about it. So I'm bringing it up right here to tell you guys, there's a good chance that if you're saying, I don't hire from TopTal, I hire from an agency, there's a good chance that those developers actually seem like they work for the agency, but actually work for TopTal. There's also a good chance that if you're competing with an agency and it feels like, man, they could do everything, how can we not do it? It's a good chance that they're hiring from TopTal. That way they get top-level quality people. They could scale up fast with them and get them started on a project fast. All right, so Lynn, for you and anyone else who's listening to me, I know you're not creating an agency on the side, but I think it's a good resource for you to know about. For you and everyone listening to me, I urge you to not just go to toptal.com when you want to hire, but go to the special URL where everybody who's listening to the sound of my voice and their friends can get up to 80, not up to, get exactly 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for eight for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. That's top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, toptal.com/mixergy. All right. Shows, by the way, Lynn, that I can keep secrets. If somebody tells me, don't say it, I'll say, all right, I won't tell it. But as I told you before the interview started, once it's in an interview, I don't edit. Go with it.
Sounds good.
So you were doing great. You built up the business to 75 million users. You guys went public. You had a great role there. Why'd you leave?
Yeah, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I was a little bored. The company got taken public. You know, I had a big team and the team's doing well. You know, on one hand, I was a little antsy. And on the other hand, you know, I kind of come to the understanding and conclusion that, you know, just this is ultimately not my company, right? So I was a very well-paid executive, you know, and the learnings were great. The kind of interaction with the all the influencers and all the early influencer work we did was great. And I was like, okay, maybe this mobile thing is here to stay. Maybe I should come up with another idea and actually found a new company.
Why does being the founder, why does being the owner, why does being the creator, why does any of that matter to you?
Yeah, you know, it's about kind of take all my lessons from, you know, the last 15 years on, you know, being with two really great startups and being with another three, like, you know, really amazing major media companies, and take all the lessons and, you know, have an idea on if I was to build a company, here are the things I would like to avoid, right? Here are the things that really slow the company down or slow me down. And here's, I'm at a point where I think I can kind of distill those lessons and understand my own weaknesses and try to build a team. You know, number one, it's about kind of being able to kind of build a team and of people that's like-minded and be able to work with you. As the company get really big, that's getting harder and harder to do. So at a bigger company, there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of time wasted.
And that's another thing I heard that bothered you. You did not want to be a manager. You did not set out in business to be a manager. You as a kid dreamt of selling candy, not managing a bunch of other people who are cogs in someone else's machine. But the part about politics in a company, you're in a publicly traded company. Talk about that. What is it like to manage people at that level? What are some of the challenges that you dealt with?
Yeah, you know, you need to establish a relationship with people where they, you know, either your subordinates or other C-level, you know, colleagues so they really tell you honestly how they feel, right? So, you know, everybody kind of, as the company get bigger, there's some hidden agenda that takes a little polling to get out.
Like right? What's a part of their hidden agenda?
You know, if we are, we kind of, I walked in a situation where, you know, I have a lot of technical background. So even though my title of the company wasn't CTO or anything, you know, the CEO really valued my opinion on technical matters. And we had a tech team turnover, leadership turnover. We were actively looking for outside CTO to come in while there are, you know, internal really great engineers or really great like managers that really was angling for the job. And we know like we're about to take the company public, and we really need a caliber of CTO that really is not kind of an internal hire, right? So or internal promotion. So that was challenging to kind of keep everybody motivated. How do you do that while not have your top developer feel demotivated or demoralized and unappreciated? So that was kind of really interesting challenge. So you know, things okay. like that.
All right. And you still didn't leave. You were just kicking around different ideas. You were thinking about them. What are some of the ideas that you were kicking around on your journey to Hooch?
So actually, really excitingly, one of the ideas after many years I was kicking around and abandoned for a while, I was able to build back into Hooch Black as part of the hotel offerings.
You knew that hotels would give lower prices to anyone who was a member. If it wasn't visible on the internet, they would be willing to do it.
Yeah, I know there was a couple of loopholes. You know, I know kind of we know hotel already have unpublished prices. And we know they basically the way to display it on that on the internet so far was either a super last minute time delimited deal, so that gets them out of the obligation to Expedia sometimes, and the other way is how Hotwire does it, right? So you basically search and they say like, hey, we found a 5-star hotel that matches your description. We can't tell you the name of the hotel, where it is. It's kind of in your area. It's $170. Just trust us and give us money. So that's a terrible experience. So there is this other third way, which is just erect a paywall, and consumers behind the paywall to in a private membership organization can access these deals. But you know, really up until 2 to 3 years ago, that was not the common behavior, right? You don't go onto a website, log in, and pay a subscription to any website search engine. It really is the advent of the app and the subscription apps that really made this all possible. You know, there always been private membership organizations that you pay and you can pick up the phone and call a concierge and they'll find you. And that's also a terrible experience because, you know, who wants to call somebody for a hotel anymore? You just want to see all the options, right? So everything kind of that was one of the ideas I was thinking about.
You knew that if you can find a way to hide it behind a paywall, you can offer these lower prices, but all the ways to hide it behind a paywall felt clunky and just uncomfortable. Like call up our concierge and you'll get the prices. That's no good. Pay for this membership and you'll get the prices. I know people do that. That wasn't good. So you just kept that in the back of your head.
Yeah. And the second idea I had was, because of my time spent at MTV, I know the casting industry is also kind of primed for disruption. I was talking to my casting director friends, and they're still doing the same thing they did 10 years ago or 15 years ago. That was basically email-based casting. They keep, everybody's photo as attachments, and it's just a terrible, terrible way to organize everything. So that was interesting.
Why did you give up on that one?
I ultimately decided on Hooch because, Hooch was my two co-founders. They already kind of were incubating this idea a little bit. They brought me in. I was kind of advising them. And at the same time, that summer of 2015, I was getting married. So me and some of my best guy friends went on my bachelor weekend trip to Miami, where I was telling everyone that, hey, I'm thinking about leaving my company and Keek as the CMO, and I want to start my own company. Here's the three ideas I'm struggling with on which one. And everybody's like, go for the one drink a day idea. That's the one that you can explain to everyone who will understand. That's the winner. So I was like, are you sure? Everybody was like, yeah, definitely.
I like how you're talking about that on your bachelor party weekend.
Sure. Yeah, we're nerds, so we can't help it. So I got married I think a few weeks later, and then on my honeymoon I told my wife that I was going to leave my very well paid public company CMO job to focus on the drinking app because that's the winner. So
what'd she say? I imagine that in retrospect it sounds rough, but I imagine she must have been supportive.
Yeah, you know, she just very recently said, you know, for good times or bad, that she's sticking with me. So she, you know, she's very supportive. She actually, incredibly supportive. And she basically said, you're very smart. I'm sure, we will figure this out. So she gave me permission to kind of quit and, you know, I quit very shortly and I was the first one to kind of, amongst my partner to work on this full time.
You know, there's a Chinese actress with the same name as you, Lin Dai. Do you
yes.
know? Right? Made a ton of movies.
Yeah. She was basically the Marilyn Monroe of the Hong Kong film industry around probably a little bit older era, kind of the black, kind of a lot of black and white famous Hong Kong film.
Yep. Cinderella and Her Little Angels, The Kingdom and the Beauty, Spring is in the Air. It just makes searching for you and like hunting down private information hard.
You know, the slight difference is actually in Chinese, you say the last name first. So my name is actually Dai Ling. So her name in Chinese is actually Lin Dai. So so it's slightly different, but in America, since you know I grew up here, it's
why did you do it that way? Why did you flip it?
You know, I think that's just, you know, I went to, junior high and high school in Arizona. So that's just like, what's your first name and what's your family name? Right. So, and it actually, you know, thank goodness my first name is so easy to pronounce versus, you know, it could be really worse, a lot worse. My parents actually, you know,
mine was Khalili. When we came to the U.S., for some reason, it was Halili, H-A-L-I-L-I. Uh-huh. And I don't know why, but it bothered my dad that it was H-A-L-I-L-I. It should have been K. And he went through, and he never does any paperwork, hates to do all that. He went in and changed it to K-H-A-L-I-L-I. It's like, who cares? Why would that bother you of all the things? All right. So you had this idea. Let's talk about what I skipped over before. The idea came to your co-founder because he was working as a doorman, right?
Yes.
And he saw this paper thing that I cut you off in the beginning of the interview as you were describing. How did that whole paper thing work? What was that?
Yeah. So in, you know, it's a New York thing to start. So it's called a drink ticket. So if you know somebody, the idea is if you know somebody and you go to a club or a bar, the doorman or the owner or the manager will slip you like a few tickets. And they're sometimes, you know, they're just like Chuck E. Cheese kind of type of raffle tickets. You then exchange that ticket. You give that to the bartender. Bartender basically just pour you a drink. And we just saw that like, you know, some of my wealthiest hedge fund friends are just so excited to get that ticket and they wait for a drink. It's not because they don't have money for the drink. It's receiving a free drink is really an aspirational experience. Like that feels like you are in the know, you are being taken care of, you are superior
right.
than the people paying full price. So we're like, oh, that's interesting. It's a discount that's not perceived as a discount. And the second aspect of this is just like understanding the economics at a bar. I mean, a bar can at volume, order wholesale bottles of Grey Goose for less than $20 a liter. So you can make 26 1.5 ounces pour out of that one bottle. So that means you can make 26 drinks.
And they charge at least $10 for it, more like 15 to 20.
Yes. At, you know, slightly more higher end places, it's 15 to 20 in cities like New York and San Francisco for sure.
So you said how many 26 pours out of that?
Yeah, 26 1.5 ounces per.
Okay, so let's say
liter.
It's $15 per. That's $390.
Yeah, it's 1400 to 1500% markup. It's the largest wholesale to retail markup on any legal product there is.
It's huge. And so you said, hey, look, these bars don't have to pay anything really for this one drink. And the other realization was, once someone comes in for one drink,
yeah, you never just have one drink. You always have more, and you are rarely drinking by yourself. You're bringing additional customer through the door. So, you know, we're tracking on average, our customers are spending about an hour 20 minutes per visit to the bar, and they're spending additional $30 to $40 per check. So, so for $1 of marketing, the bar can get 30 to 40 times return for that. So it's kind of a no-brainer.
And so you said, all right, this could be the, this could be the thing. He started building it. How far along did he get before you decided to join in after that?
He showed me a prototype, and we were friends for many, many years. Showed me a prototype. I actually was like, wow, this was a pretty well-built app. Let me try to find out which app developer he used. Maybe I can recruit him for one of my two other projects. The more kind of we talked, and I just got, I fell in love with the idea, and I got sucked into it more. After kind of, meeting both co-founders, we thought that my skill set really complemented, theirs, right? So, one is from the nightlife industry, one is a performance marketing user acquisition expert. I've been operating digital companies for quite a while. So, the three of us got together, and we the first thing is I made everybody write a check to the company. So we said we need to rebuild the app, a commercial version of the app. We had to go to a design studio to do that. I'll negotiate a very favorable rate, but we all need to put in a little bit of money ourselves. So we did that. So I know everybody is committed. And then the second thing is I just quit my job. First one to do this full time.
Because you wanted them. Did you need the money or did you want their commitment?
I want their commitment. So I wanted their commitment. Obviously, we could go out and, start raising money immediately because we already had a prototype. But, I want to make sure I'm getting in bed with co-founders that are as committed as me.
Was it called Hooch at the time?
Yeah. So it was called Hooch. That's a genius of a name. It's a prohibition term for illegal whiskey. It has that kind of speakeasy and a little bit bad type of feel.
And a bit of an in the know. I remember going to my first speakeasies in New York, and it was like, you have to go underground, essentially, go to a back door, then there's a dude sitting there, and you tell him that you know it's a thing, and then he finally lets you in, and
it's a thing. It's a private cocktail society. That was our branding right out of the gate. So, it's like everything else in New York. The more you say it's private, it's not for you, everybody wants in. So,
all right, let me talk about my sponsor, and then we'll get into how you built this up and then how you raised money from people like Russell Simmons and others despite the difficulty. But my sponsor is a company called HostGator. And I noticed, by the way, that Hooch, you guys still host, I think, on WordPress. I'm looking at an earlier version of your website. It's just basic WordPress. That's been the thing that 30% of all websites are built on. Well, you know what? For WordPress hosting, you don't have to pay an arm and a leg. You just want to get WordPress hosting by someone who can do it right and get out of your way so you can build your business up. Let me see. You still to this day use WordPress. Let me see what theme you guys are using. I always like to do that. The theme is called Avada. So all this stuff, super simple. Even high-end companies like yours are using WordPress to host their websites. So the question then is, if you're going to get your website hosted by WordPress, who are you going to hire? Who are you going to get to do this? And the company that I recommend is HostGator. I went with them because they've been around forever. How many interviewees have I talked to who said, then my hosting company went down, then my hosting company went out of business, then my hosting company, all these issues. You should not have to think about it. Think about your business, your product, your customers, not think about, will my website be up? Not today, not in 2018. And so that's why I recommend going with HostGator, a company that's been around forever. If anyone out there is looking for a hosting company for their idea, I urge you to sign up, not just for HostGator's simple plan. I get no extra money if you guys sign up for a basic or the Lex level up. But Lynn, I'm going to tell you why I'm going to suggest they get the baby plan. It offers unlimited domains. I was just interviewing a guy named Devin Zander who had a ton of ideas. Dozens, literally dozens of ideas. He was going to do this SEO, and he was going to do that marketing. He was going to do this other thing, which is e-commerce. All these different ideas. They worked, but there were a lot of them, and some of them were just kind of blah. How do you get to try all these ideas really fast? How do you experiment really fast? Well, he told me that he signed up back when he was building his company with HostGator. And one of the nice things about HostGator is they will, if you sign up for their baby plan, which is just like $3.98 a month, you could have unlimited domains. I mean, you have an idea, fire up a domain, see if it works, put it out there. If it doesn't, you just move on. If it does, you can build on it. That's why so many people who I've interviewed have used HostGator. In fact, Devin now has a huge mega success with smart apps. It's e-commerce apps. I think, I don't know how many millions he's doing with this app company. All right. But it all started with HostGator. If you're out there and you want to get started, go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. You'll get a super low rate and you'll get tagged as one of my people. Every sponsor always takes really good care of my people. Or if you hate your hosting company, bring your hosting over to HostGator. They will help you move. They'll make it simple and they'll host you right. HostGator.com/Mixergy. Super low price and 45-day money back guarantee to make sure that you are absolutely thrilled with their service. All right. You know, since you say everyone likes a free drink, do you have any experience with HostGator? I saw you're about to say something.
Yeah, no, I was saying kind of like, it's amazing how far we come on kind of managed hosting services, right? So, I mean, I remember my first company, we literally were like building racks and racks of servers. Right? And that took away so much energy and time. It's so much better now that like pretty much anybody can, you know, like you said, for $3 to $4, you can get your business up and running. I mean, we were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and like, you know, wasting days and days just to get our company up and running.
Go to those co-location facilities where it's like military bases with their security.
Yeah.
You go in, you racked up your own servers?
Yes, we did. So we had, you know, we were processing kind of, you know, millions and millions of users. And that was, you know, AWS wasn't around and there was like really no efficient way to do this other than actually just kind of lease or buy your own equipment and do it, right? So
you got the team to quit or to go in and put money into the business. You quit your job. You needed a little bit of money. You went to friends and family. Which friends and family did you know that were able to? When I saw on AngelList, I didn't see the list of people, but I saw that you raised your seed fund was 1.25, right?
Yeah.
So how did you get 1.25 from friends and family?
You know, it kind of just snowballed. We had some, we had some young people that we know that you know in New York that loves technology and love to go out. So those are people we hit up first. Those are friends that. You know, basically
because they had good jobs and they were able to put up like $25,000. Is that the kind of thing?
Yeah. So it started at like kind of $25,000-$50,000 from our kind of investment banker friends, who's very enthusiastic about this. I mean, if you like putting the context, you know, some of our friends will go out to like clubs like Marquee and Tao, and they may spend $50,000 one night. On club, you know, table and bottle service.
Why? Because they're taking clients out?
Clients out or friends out or, you know, just having a great night with
$50,000?
That's kind of the genius of Noah and Jason from Tao Group that kind of started this trend of kind of, you know, in cities like New York and LA and Vegas, it's at clubs, it's table bottle service, right? So it's also a super high margin product. So it's one bottle of Grey Goose, like we said, that costs less than $20. You give everybody, you serve that at a couch for a group of friends, and you can charge $500, $600 per bottle for that.
I've seen that, but then how do you get to 50,000? This is Jason Strauss. I didn't know. He was the guy who innovated all this?
Noah Tappenberg and Jason Strauss innovated, really took, you know, table and bottle service to, you know, when they opened the club Marquee. So, you know, you can also buy, high-end champagne. Jay-Z owns a champagne company called Ace of Spades and that could run you $10,000 per bottle.
How much money does a person make that they could spend $50,000 just with friends?
You know, in, it's the high end consumer experience, right? So you are at a club and you are maybe enjoying your favorite DJ and you're bringing a group of people out. It could be clients, you know, could be a girl you really like to impress. You know, I was actually in China after many, many years. I went back. The kind of capitalism, it's just an indication of kind of a little bit of the access, the access you can buy and the excess of capitalism, right? In China, literally, I mean, I'd never seen this before, but in the US, at least when you go to a great club and you're ordering bottles and you and your friends are trying to finish it, you're trying to get your money worth, right? In China, at the big clubs, if somebody at the table next to you bought 10 bottles of champagne to put on the table, you're going to order 15 bottles of champagne, even though you're not a champagne drinker. So, I mean, they don't even put it on ice because they don't intend to drink it at all. They just buying it to show off.
Just to show that they can. So let me ask you this. I know that you were in Toronto around this, just before you started Hooch. So you weren't fully connected, but when you had friends of friends of friends who could spend $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 in a night, and you're working at a regular job, does this feel like, what's wrong with me? Do you feel like you need to get yourself in gear? How do you feel about it?
You know, it's really interesting. So I think American education system actually never truly prepare you for kind of the job or understand what a job truly is. I never knew. I thought finance, which Carnegie Mellon had a really great finance track. I thought finance meant accounting, right? So I was like, well, I don't want to do that. So I want to be an entrepreneur, which end of the day is very far more rewarding because you're actually creating, you know, I hear my finance friends complain about how, you know, they're not creating any actual tangible substance. They just take one thing and trade it for another. But, you know, in New York, it's largely finance based. And I have a lot of great friends who are great people. They just, you know, they're under a lot of pressure in work. They like to blow off steam. And you know, and sometimes they rightly deserve so. I mean, they're...
So you didn't say to yourself, these guys are so much better than me or better off than I am. I have to go and fight to get to that level. You just said, you know what? They have a high-pressure job. They need to blow off steam. They don't get to leave a legacy or a product behind the way that I've gotten to. Let them have their thing. I'm happy with my thing. That's the way you felt?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for every 10,000 or 100,000 kind of bankers that make $1 million a year, you know, there's like a Steve and Steve Jobs and there's Elon Musk. And who do you really want to be at the end of the day, right? I aspire to really create something and maybe build a business and that can really leave the impact versus just kind of trading security instruments in and out.
Okay, so you're seeing these people, you're raising money from them, you start to refresh the look of the app, you publish. How did you get people to download this and understand that this was a real thing worth putting their money for? Because I know it's only 10 bucks a month, but people are super cheap.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. The first kind of, you know, the first time we actually got press was organic press. We were beta testing the app and Time Out magazine got their hands on a copy of the beta without us pitching them. And they wrote an article calling us Hooch the best drinking app in New York. So we were actually kind of faced with a dilemma to actually, you know, we got this great piece of press that was
They called you one of five best drinking apps, right?
Correct. And we were listed as number one.
Number
one on the list. So we made a quick decision to go live out of the beta and into a publicly downloadable.
Just because of this. Now, I'm looking at the article right now. You told our producer about it. We hunted it down. It's not that hard to hunt down, but I've got it here in front of me. It's a blur. It's two sentences. That was enough to rock your – and two sentences and the photo at the top – was your photo for the app. I'm recognizing now that I had some experience with it, right?
Yeah,
no,
absolutely.
No. So, the photo at the top, I take it back, was Minibar. So okay. It's just two sentences. Two sentences rocked your world enough that you got more downloads, more customers, and enough for you to just say, let's get out of beta and go launch?
Yeah, you know, we've been kind of internally kind of struggling a little bit on like, you know, because there's always the next tweak, right, to make it a little bit better. So we got to a point where, you know, I had to make a decision as the CEO just to say, like, we need to launch, right? So this is a better opportunity than any to actually get this out into the real world in the hands of real consumers who can definitely tell us a lot more about, you know, it's about iteration of the product.
It's not so much that this got such a flood of people that you had to launch. It was more like, hey, guys, we were looking for an activity to just get ourselves kicked off. This is a good one. They've announced us. Let's go out of beta and live up to the announcement.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to get real world feedback. That's the main thing, right? So it was kind of like we can sit in a lab and, you know, dream up scenarios how people would use this. It's nothing is better than actually getting in the hands of a few hundred customers and see their reaction. So,
and this all happened this just happened. It wasn't that you pitched them. Who was it? Someone Dow, Dan Dow. It wasn't that you pitched Dan Dow. You guys weren't buddies or anything.
No. Dan actually, somebody actually from Time Out reached out to us to say like, hey, this article just went live and then you are in the print version next week. So we're like, all right, let's just go live with the app. We quickly learned a lot and then decided that, hey, we need to actually be serious with our PR effort. So we, by the end of the year had a PR firm. And by January, we got coverage we launched in LA and then got coverage in LA Times. So that was a huge boost. So we got a ton of download from the LA Times article. And then by March, we decided that we're gonna stop by South by Southwest to see, what's shaking. And luckily, some of my past contacts within in Austin at the same time, we were able to kind of get Rick Ross and Busta Rhyme and Ludacris to stop by kind of three nights of events that we're hosting at one of our huge venues, pop-up venues in Austin.
How? So,
artists were in town already, so we kind of cut a. And nobody believed how little we pay for the art to stop by. And we had I had a relationship and pulled some favors, but they're in town already. We didn't have to fly them in.
So you paid to get them to come in, but you still needed friends and favors.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we probably ended up paying each of the artists about like less than 10% of what they normally would charge for an appearance.
So we're talking single figure thousands of dollars to get them to come in.
Yes, absolutely. So, and then they saw the consumer excitement about Hooch because everybody, we give away a free drink to everybody, right? So like at South by Southwest, we just gave everyone attending South by a free version of the app. So everybody was just like buzzing about Hooch and they're getting free drinks at the club. So the artist kind of voluntarily got on a mic and start performing. So we were just kind of paying them to stop by. They end up doing kind of 40-minute sets. So it was tremendous. And then we participated in a startup pitch competition that Anheuser-Busch was hosting. So we thought it was a really well-fit pitch competition for a drinking app to be in a startup competition by the biggest beer company in the world. And out of a few hundred companies, we actually ended up winning that pitch competition. So it was tremendous validation that the alcohol industry really took this seriously.
Rosario Dawson is an actress, and among other things, she became an investor of yours after meeting you at some. I have too many freaking tabs at this point in the interview, but she came to some charity event that you guys hosted. She met you. She understood the app. She invested. I'm wondering, what are these events that you put on? Who do you invite to them? How do you use them to grow your business?
Yeah, so we try to get involved with anything that really kind of targets the young professional millennials that like to go out, right? So so there was a Christmas charity event in LA, and we were kind of in pre-launch mode in LA, so want to get the name out. So we supported the event and we made Santa hats with the word Hooch. I think we literally painted it on ourselves with glitter and gave it to all the celebrities that came. And Scott Eastwood and Rosario Dawson were at the event and they actually jumped behind the bar and started serving everybody free drinks. So so that was really kind of the first interaction we had.
Sorry, because it's an event for charity, she feels like she could jump behind the bar and support the charity. It's not like she's supporting Hooch, but because you're connected, I see. All right.
Absolutely. So I actually wasn't at the event. I didn't meet her until, maybe over more than a year later when we kind of were reconnected and we're talking about an opportunity for her to kind of participate and invest in the company. So
how did you connect with her then again?
So after South by Southwest, we got a lot of press and inbound inquiry from different VCs. We ended up working with Blue Scorpion Investment, which is a VC firm in New York, to put together our second round. And they actually had a great network of celebrity investors. One of the two partners were kind of creative director at Diesel and Red Bull before, and had a lot of great celebrity contacts. And he was like suggesting some of the people we should reach out to. And he brought up Rosario. And I was like, actually, Rosario already kind of knowingly or unknowingly was, one of our first celebrity photos with her. So he put us in touch, and she's a pleasure to work with, and she's just an activist, an entrepreneur, and she's speaks at a lot of conferences that we actually speak at. So.
All right, let me close it out then, since we brought up investors, with the difficulty you had raising money. You told our producer, look, I never talked about this, but I'd be up for talking to Andrew about not just the trouble I had raising money, but also what I had to do to break free of that. What was the trouble? Talk about the issue with Hooch raising money.
Yeah, I had, as you know, I had two pretty successful startups before, and we raised tens of millions of dollars. We end up taking the company public and returning investor a lot of money. So I thought this was a no-brainer, right? So I look at Hooch as a data platform where we have a lot of data based on the subscription model, and we share it with the alcohol companies and really help them solve a lot of marketing and targeting problems that they face. So what I didn't realize is in the VC community, once we got out of the friends and family round, once we got out of the, my banker friend who spends $50,000 a night at a club, when we're seriously and we're approaching institutional investors, a lot of major VC funds actually have charters in their rules that they cannot invest in any project in the vice category, right? So that's gambling, drinking, pornography, and cannabis. So
I like how you linked in with pornography.
Yeah, so which is like really shockingly, we're talking about a behavior. Drinking is a behavior, two out of three Americans partake, right? So it just has such a negative connotation. And then, some of the funds, even if they don't have clear distinction in their charter for that they cannot invest in drinking company, it was just such a risk, right? So why risk a early stage investment of a few hundred thousand dollars when, your major kind of LPs are the Ohio Teachers Association? They may have, question you about the morality of investing in this company. So I never knew that before. So that kind of knocked out about one third of the kind of the target list that just cannot directly make an investment in an alcohol based business. So after really getting a understanding of that, we really kind of just worked harder. We just closed our first price round that was $5 million on a $15 million pre $20 million post valuation, and that was I literally probably, if you see the spreadsheet of people I actually emailed and talked to on a one-on-one basis, not just mass email, it's a 300 people list.
300 people just because of that. Because these restrictions of people. By the way, this is not public yet, that you just closed that round. I don't see it anywhere online.
It's not.
It'll be public by the time that this interview is published, but okay.
Right.
Wow. So then who'd you raise this money from?
Rosario is one of the investors in this most recent round.
She's not a big investor in the round.
It's not. So it's led
by. So the first round was seed, friends, and family. The second round was that firm that you just mentioned,
Blue Scorpion Investments.
They have such a non-traditional startup background. I think one of the guys is from Credit Suisse. The other one had a creative agency company, used to work at Red Bull, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's actually what we really love about them. They're not traditional VCs, and as I talk, I have very kind of love and hate relationship with prior VCs that was
my company. Who booted you out of your own company? Yes.
So we really saw eye to eye with kind of the creative vision of the company, and our VCs are actually true partners in our company, and they gave a lot of great feedback, and they're very readily open. Openly introduce us to their entire network. I never seen a VC do that, right? So because hedge funds and VCs, you know, they make their money on taking 2% and 20% carry on the money.
I don't know.
Manage.
I found that now at this point, a lot of them are there because of the relationships they could open up for you.
And yeah, I mean, it's very refreshing because they directly introduced high caliber people like Len Blavatnik, who's the 24 wealthiest billionaire on the Forbes list, and Chris Burch, Tory Burch's ex-husband and co-founder, and they all kind of fell in love with Hooch and separately wrote personal checks into the company. So that was our
and it seems like that's where their money comes from, that they have worked with Jameson Ernst, one of the two founders or principals of the company. He worked with Forbes 400 billionaires and celebrities and helped them, I think, with their investments. They both have investment banking backgrounds. And as a result of the people whose money they managed, they were able to raise money for their fund and also make introductions to you. Am I understanding this right?
Yeah, they have a very unique LP list, which is really the who's and who in kind of celebrities and other industries. So we thought, hey, Hooch is really a lifestyle brand. It makes sense to take money from celebrities who is going to freely, promote us for free, more or less, right? So we had Maxwell and All American Rejects, all these great celebrities that just organically post about us because they're so enthusiastic.
Because they're investors. I see.
Correct.
So what did you say to them that got them to feel comfortable with you?
With Blue Scorpion Investments. So they actually they reached out to me, and I didn't take a meeting for quite a few weeks. They heard about the South by Southwest success, and one of my friends knows them and showed them what we were doing. So they were kind of looking at consumer space, and they really believe in the subscription model, and we were very kind of unique concept in, kind of 2016 when we first started talking. So
I could see that. They also invested in Quip, the toothbrush by subscription
Absolutely.
Company.
I mean, they,
all right, and you were starting to say you raised $5 million recently?
We raised $5 million.
Five from
recently.
Whom?
Mostly institutional investors and some celebrities and some strategics. We're probably going to announce that in about 2 weeks, the actual list. So
I understand that you put together a spreadsheet. Let me understand, how did you get 200 to 300, or I guess it's more than 300 companies on the spreadsheet? How did you decide how to call them, how to structure it? What was your process there?
It was really referrals, right? So we reach out to people, existing investors and other investors that can really introduce us to, it's not about the round you're raising now, it's about the value of your investor that who can bring you the next round. So we started that process and fairly early on. And part of the lesson I learned was you have to focus. If you're in fundraising mode, you got to spend 90% of your time fundraising. We kind of made a mistake very early on, kind of beginning of 2017. We were, I was part-time fundraising. I was spending maybe 25% of my time on this. And then kind of that mistake combined with, a third of the VCs I'm talking to who really love the concept, but their hands are tied and they cannot invest in alcohol companies. So that kind of went on to the point where, by the summer, I was like, we need to be really serious about this. So, I spoke to my kind of partners, reshifted some of the operational roles. And, I was starting the summer spending about probably close to 90% of my time focused on this route.
And it was a lot of talking to someone, getting referrals, adding them to the spreadsheet. That's right?
Yeah.
And then following up with, go ahead.
It's follow up, right? So that's the number one thing you need to do is, be organized and stay on top. And, I hate using kind of automated mail drip campaigns. So I made a point to kind of personally reach out, write somebody an email that, find out something about them and really,
You personally would look them up, find something about them, and then send them a note?
Yeah, absolutely. Even if it was a warm intro from one of our existing investors that, so great. I look and learn about their background, right? So which, with LinkedIn, everything you can Wikipedia, you can get a pretty good understanding. And really kind of pitch it passionately. I think end of the day.
In the first email you're pitching them? In the first email you're saying, I've got this app, it's going well, here's our monthly recurring revenue. I want to see if you'd be a good fit.
No, so I never volunteer information. I always, start with like, hey, great to connect. Something flattering about them, like this is what I learned about you. This is like great. I'd love to, get your advice, right? You kind of sometimes it's great to just like not even ask for money. And then share some of the latest press clippings we have. So that's one thing that's great about Hooch is people press love to write about us. Who doesn't like to write about free drinks? We're always kind of coming up with new ways and new offerings. So the positive press definitely helps keeping the investors engaged, and then always just try to get to that meeting. So it's not about the deal over email. It's really about getting an in-person meeting if possible, if not, get them on call. So it trends when the founder is passionately talking about their company in a way that email doesn't.
And you would have to then fly out and talk to them. How do you avoid people who are just curious and will have you come and have a meeting with them? How do you avoid wasting your time on the wrong people? Or just trying to learn?
You do end up spending a lot of time with people like that, right? So it's one of the unfortunate things that you kind of have to just follow through every lead. You kind of can rule out the fact they could be a potentially great investor. That's another challenge. I think the VC community in general is an unspoken rule that they never say no because they don't want to tell you no, and then later you become Uber and they can't get into a later round. They were, I would rather, I think for all entrepreneurs, we would rather just hear no, right? So, I think we got that probably from 10% of the people that actually literally told us exactly why they don't think this is right for them. There's a large population that just kind of to this point they're like very interested but they didn't write a check, right? So
you did it. I'm looking now at like all the different celebrities who've invested. I feel like the Huffington Post did an article about how you got about your app and then also how you attracted celebrities. I don't feel like they went into enough depth about it. But I do see the list of investors from their article that's impressive. Sean White, Russell Simmons, Tyson Ritter, Maxwell, who you mentioned earlier, and then Rosario Dawson and others. Rocco Despirito, also an investor, the celebrity chef.
Yes, Rocco actually created a line of, we kind of connected on the idea of, if we're going to do cocktails, let's do healthy cocktails, let's do healthier cocktails. Let's take out the sugar. So he actually created a whole line of healthy drink recipes that we are piloting with the Dream Hotel and Tell Group now only on the Hooch app.
So the only way to get that's a weird thing though, right? It is kind of cool that I get exclusive drinks and I get to show it. For some people, going into a bar and showing the Hooch app feels a little bit weird, right?
Yeah, so you kind of, I think the two challenges we face, number one is when people first heard about the idea, like $10 for 30 drinks, it's like they're like, it's too good to be true. What's right. The catch, right? So, there's no catch because the bar is giving you that free drink. It doesn't cost me $10 every time you, you're getting free drink. And the second thing is just really, you got to get over the hump. Is this real, right? So if you try it the first time and the bartender is just give you a free drink, you're like, oh, this actually works. So after that, it's the, you know, the first time is a little intimidating. So that's why we kind of, event marketing is big for us, because when you are in a venue with a lot of other Hooch members, there's like 100 people all getting free drinks at the same time. Like, it's kind of like a group thing. So
and then the bartenders know what to do about it too.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
It looks like you even have a free trial, right? Am I in the free trial right now?
You are in the free trial. So,
and it's going to go on for how long?
It's going to go on for until you receive your claim your first drink. So you can try a.
You want me to just try a first drink? You're doing what you want the bars to do. Get someone to have a free drink, and then you know that they're going to pay.
Then you can make a decision. Absolutely.
And then I was wondering too whether you had to give Apple 30% cut because you've got an in-app purchase. But you don't. You let me pay with Apple Pay, but you don't go through the App Store. How do you get around that? Is it because it's food?
Yeah, because it's a real world membership. You are actually redeeming kind of drinks, and so it's not an actual digital purchase. Mm. So you are actually purchasing. So we can actually run it through Stripe. You can use your Apple Pay. Or any other credit card store payment that you can store with Stripe. So we actually don't touch your credit card data at all.
You guys pick some really I don't know about the rest of the country, but I know San Francisco. I thought I knew a lot of places. I don't know a lot of these places, and they just look phenomenal. All right. I also think it helps.
Peanut Gallery is great in San Francisco. That's a
– Which place?
A stable. I think it's 111 Mina Gallery. That's a place I know every time. I don't know a lot of San Francisco places, but every time I'm in town, that's definitely one of the places the first go-to I stop by. So
the other big benefit of this is your app looks freaking gorgeous. So it doesn't look like something. It doesn't look like Groupon, which also had a really nice design. It feels like something exclusive, something Black Card. I think you nailed it with the design. All right. For anyone who wants to go try it, just go into the App Store, search Hooch, or go to hooch.co. And more importantly, I'm just fascinated by how you built up this business, and I'm glad that you're here to talk about it. I'm looking forward to seeing how you guys grow. And, I should thank my two sponsors. Yes, the two companies that help make this possible. Really, if you need a website hosted, get it hosted right. Hostgator.com/Mixergy. And I always want to know your feedback on my sponsors. So if you have a good experience, let me know. If you have a bad experience, let me know. Andrew@Mixergy.com. And the second sponsor is a company that will help you host your website right. It's called company that will help you hire an X-ray developer, toptal.com/Mixergy. Lynn, you've stayed on longer than we originally planned, and I really appreciate the time. Congratulations, and thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Andrew.
Right on. Bye. Bye, everyone.